Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner, and I'm here with a great writer and dear friend, Baynard Woods, who for a long time was an editor and writer for the Baltimore City Paper, where he's still editor-at-large. He writes for The Guardian, The New York Times, Washington Post, and wrote this novel, Coffin Point, The Strange Cases of Ed McTeer, which Dr. Sheriff, which we could do a whole show by itself, because it's such a fascinating book. And he's back in the studio now with this because the piece he wrote in Vox... My wife and I don't want kids ever, so I decided to get a vasectomy.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark.
Have you, man.
And, I that was a piece that I'd thought about for a long time and about not having kids. We'd known for a long time that we didn't want to have kids. And I think I wrote a failed version of this for City Paper in the form of a review. The writer Megan Daum edited a book a couple of years ago about not with essays from writers who didn't want to have kids. And so in reviewing that, I tried to sort of think of the ways, the reasons that we didn't. And because we don't have that many, we're in our 40s now, but we don't have that many role models of people that we know who haven't had kids. And so it's sort of a way to think about that. And I failed badly in my first try at it in the City Paper review. Like, it just didn't work. It wasn't a form for a story. And so this was able to give sort of the room to have a narrative of, like, something happens, I get my scrotum cut open. And so, you know, that's action.
The whole idea that just...
I mean, you need some action in a story, and that had some action and some ups and downs and some... instead of it just being philosophical musings, it had some stakes, I feel like, a little bit more. I've been really happy that mainly women have given me really good responses to it. As I was worried about that as a man writing about reproductive choices, you know?
Well, I'm not surprised women gave you some positive feedback on the piece, because you write about in here men never have any responsibility in the area of birth control. It's always on the woman to either take birth control since she's 15 or 16 years old and continue taking it, or the use of condoms, but it's never on the man's side.
Yeah, and I mean, in my relationship, my wife has our whole relationship been on the pill, and so she wanted to see what life was like without this extra rush of hormones and stuff, and so yeah, I felt like it was time for me to carry that. That's what I told my doctor. It was time for me to carry that burden for our family, because she had carried it for all of the time before that.
He liked that.
Yeah, she did.
She liked that.
Did like that. At first, she told us to wait when I first approached her about it 2 years ago. And so then she finally...
You agreed?
Yeah, well, she said, make sure you think about it and stuff. And I mean, yeah, I agreed, cause mainly out of just like laziness. Who wants to go to the doctor, and who also wants to get their scrotum cut open? And so, you're happy to take a chance to wait if you can, you know?
Well, one of the things I said to you, and I think I texted to both of you, you and Nicole, was that... one of the things, besides the very kind of humorous and poignant way you write this about your experiences getting this vasectomy, which we'll get into some gory detail in a moment, but was a huge subtext here for me was your relationship, you and Nicole's relationship, the kind of world you have that is very equitable, and the way you describe you have your family meetings, the two of you, and I mean, that to me was really, really struck me. Your relationship was what struck me. It stood out even more than your poor little scrotum getting cut.
Hey, it ain't so little.
I couldn't resist.
Those are the doctor's words. I mean, it really was. That was the thing I really wanted to write about, was more in a way as a love letter to Nicole and to our relationship, which mainly, like, the intentionalness and all of these things really do come from her. She's very calm and measured, and I certainly, when we met, it was much more of a hothead, and I'm much more of the sort of rash one, but I do really well in crises, and she does really well in the day-to-day and doesn't necessarily do well in crises. So we figured out how to make those things work for us, and so when we were deciding for sure that we weren't going to have kids, it really was an affirmation of each other that we weren't stay. We didn't have that raison d'etre to stay together, for our relationship to be together. And so what is it about each other that we can sort of become this primary thing to each other while also having more room for the rest of the world? But we've always had family meetings where we have a ledger and we write the pros and cons of all of the big decisions in our lives, and we go through them and it's stated, and we can go back and look at when we made these big decisions. And it's really been sort of an amazing thing. But this decision we didn't put in the ledger, weirdly, partly out of laziness, but partly we were so agreed on it. We didn't know that there were really any cons at all for us of not having kids. And you know, just to be clear, because I've been arguing with a couple people who maybe took it differently, I wasn't trying to condemn. I mean, there were a lot of moral reasons I got into and stuff for us not having kids, but I wasn't trying to condemn other people for having kids. It's not a thing that's saying no one should do this. But rather that for us, here's all of the reasons, here's all the thinking that went into it for why we didn't. And that's what I feel like a lot of people have appreciated, that you don't hear that perspective that often of like, here's all the reasons why we're not doing this. And so other people who have made that same decision have been really sort of buoyed by having someone say it in public.
But I mean, you kind of, it's interesting the way you traverse the territory of not wanting to have children in this piece. I mean, from your dystopian view of the future, which is pretty thick.
Yeah.
To your stories about your own family and your parents' brothers, your father's brothers?
No, it was my brother.
Your brother, and your parents.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My father's brothers.
Who did not have kids,
Kids, yeah.
And what their lives were like, and comparatively speaking.
Yeah, I mean, one of my father's brothers was actually married his cousin, and so they didn't have kids. We're from South Carolina, so, you know, that's how it goes. And so they didn't have kids for that reason, and they it sort of drifted apart. They knew each other as kids, and they remet at Carter's inauguration. And so they always lived up here and worked in and around government and stuff, and they were really inspiring in a lot of ways. And my other aunt and uncle, who helped me a lot with Coffin Point, with the book, which was reported down in Beaufort, South Carolina, where they had lived all of that time. And so, yeah, those were very much, when I looked for role models, those were some people that were kind of role models. But, yeah, I mean, the deep pessimism about the future is a thing that Nicole doesn't necessarily share, although Trump's election made her concede a little bit. Unfortunately, I would way rather be wrong, but I mean, a friend who I worked with 10 years ago texted and said, yeah, you know that thing about, they said you didn't want to have kids because they'd end up living in a Cormac McCarthy novel. I agree with that now, and it's sad. But that's sort of, I think one of the things I say is your grandkids are either going to be cannibals or eaten by cannibals.
As you wrote, yes.
And, I would love to be wrong about that.
Well, no, you know, I think that, not to digress into this too much, I want to stick with this, but I think that's something that some people think about a lot. When you think about, is when he was elected, I thought mostly about my children, my grandchildren, what comes beyond them, what world they're going to face. You know, it's a very real thing. This is not, you know, it's and when you have kids, as you're saying, that becomes a huge piece of your thinking and your time that you invested. That's part of it. You didn't want to invest in that. You want to invest it in each other.
Yeah, yeah. And in the future still, but not in a future that has to come from our genes or from our loins. You know, Nicole's a professor, and so she has numerous students that and I have a lot of younger people in my life from city paper people and bands and stuff like that. And so we feel like we have a lot of intergenerational things in our lives. But we don't necessarily need to. Yeah, I mean, as a student of Plato and when I was in school and stuff, like one of the things in the Republic, private families are outlawed. Because
I saw that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You focus on yourself rather than on the collective good. And you want to have a private home to protect your kids. And then you want that home to be better. And then you want those kids to have more than other people. And that is the thing that ultimately ends for him. The worry of that is it ultimately always leads to tyranny. And we see that with Trump now. We see that, you know, you want That's what autocracy does, or our kleptocracy does, is steal from the public good to enrich your family, and then also try to harm the people that insult you or whatever. And so I think that that's a thing that that's one of the things that I was really thinking about. I don't want to do that. It's like with a house where you – when you own a house – you know, all of our neighbors who are owners think we're not good neighbors because we're renters. I think they're not good neighbors because all they care about is their property value in this abstract way. And they may that may cause them to make decisions that are bad for the neighborhood as a whole because they think it'll make their house worth less money, which isn't what I think the judge should be.
I love that. So, yes, because you have your apartment, you have your zip cars, and it works.
Yeah, yeah. It seems, and again, after Trump, it seems like not owning anything is the way to go.
The conversation on vasectomies you did here was really interesting. The traversing through, first going to a doctor in a Catholic hospital, which I'm sure I know which one it is in Baltimore, that many of us go to for their physicians here, and then to your look politically and also about who's getting these things and who's not. But I mean, that's... Your initial shock at not the doctor saying we don't do these.
Yeah, I mean, I was, and my doctor also at that same Catholic hospital referred me to their urology department, and then they wouldn't. When I called them, they were just sort of shocked. No, we don't do that. And I was shocked. I didn't get it at first, and then then I was like, oh, because they're Catholic, and that's they don't do that, and so. As someone who has never, ever had sex with the purpose of procreating, it was just completely foreign to me. And as someone, as a man who's never had other people tell me what to do with my business like that, that also was really shocking. So then I went to a hospital right around the corner from here where we're speaking at the moment. And, and they were willing to do the thing. And I mean, as if we're in like Brooklyn or something, I bump into a novelist I know in the waiting room who's also getting the same thing done. Fortunately, I was worried he might be there for ED or something like that I didn't want to know about and didn't want him to be embarrassed. And you know, but fortunately, he was having the same thing done I was.
But, you know, I was shocked when you talked about the procedure. We just thought the procedure was – it was very funly – it was very humorously written. I loved it. I was just – from the sound of the razor blade on.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that's – you have to go in there and take off your pants, and then a guy comes in and starts to shave your scrotum. And I was a little offended when he was assumed that I'd never had that done by a man before. I mean, who is he to say? But in fact, I hadn't. And yeah, you hear this whisking. And, I mean, it was fast. I was like, that's kind of – I was a little nervous there, but I guess you can cut it anyway. So and, yeah, then they stick these huge, huge needles in. And that was excruciatingly painful. Trigger warning or whatever here. it was cringe. I mean, it was tough. But it was bizarre because they were trying to keep me distracted and talking to me and stuff. And the conversation. So what they do is they cut it open, the scrotum open, and then they pull your testicles out, or part of it, the vas deferens, which they end up cutting, out of the sac and cut it. And so they make four cuts because for each testicle, they'll cut both sides so it doesn't just like grow back together. There are these weird cases where guys who got vasectomies a long time ago, the tubes ended up growing back together. And if they remarried much younger women, the younger women would end up getting pregnant while these guys are like 80 and with their 21-year-old wife or whatever. And because it had had enough time to grow back together. But now they clamp it also, cauterize it. So you smell your own vas deferens burning.
Right.
And then as we're doing that, they start talking about the Freddie Gray case.
Because, well, you started out by saying, they said, what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
You said you covered trials and police.
Right. So I told them I was writing a story about this. And so I'd maybe have some questions to ask. And they were real interested that I was writing the story. And then they're like, what do you normally write about? So I started telling them, and we start talking about, yeah. And But it was just the worst possible thing for me to be talking about, because after, I mean, we sat right here one of the days after one of the trials, and there had been with Doug Colbert, and there had been all day on the wall a projection of this man's spine that taken right. out, and you know, it's just such a tragic and a horrible thing that, like, that was not the thing that I needed to be wanted to be thinking about at that moment. And then they sort of started injecting their own political opinions about that case and about the medical examiner and all of this stuff into it. And you know, they really weren't trying to be inappropriate, but it was fairly wildly inappropriate and uncomfortable.
So, but I was surprised you walked out. You walked out of there? I mean, nobody had to drive you home? You just walked out afterwards?
Well, actually, your former intern, Aaron Hinken, he drove me home. He came and picked right. me up. Yeah, I started with a volunteer, I guess, and then your producer.
Right.
He came and picked me up.
Oh, okay.
But I walked out the door and everything fine, but I wasn't going to walk all the way home. And I didn't want to have to explain to a cab driver or an Uber guy or something. And Aaron was gracious enough to – and he'd had the procedure done some years earlier, so he knew what I was
– Are you sure he wants the world to know this?
Yeah. Well, I think – you know, they have two wonderful kids, and so I don't think he minds. I'll ask him at band practice today, and we'll cut this part if necessary. But he got me lunch and stuff because Nicole was at work. But yeah, I was surprised when the novelist who went in before me, he walked out and he's like, everything's fine. It's cool.
But the pain afterwards you described.
Yeah.
So he had went through the same kind of pain.
Yeah. So me and him were shocked and worried when it didn't. They said, you know, they do a little bit. I mean, some people had great experiences with it. Another friend that had it at the same time as us was done after 2 days, was up and about again. For my part, 5 days in, they say it'll be 72 hours and you're fine. Sit on frozen peas, watch Netflix or something. And so we did that, had a great weekend. Then on Tuesday, I did it on a Friday. Then on Tuesday, I try to walk the dog and I'm a block away at the park and feel like I've been kicked, you know, and that sort of in your gut doubling over. And I was – then I hit this existential despair. What am I doing? I was healthy. I walk around. I don't have a car or anything. I walk around for my job. How am I ever going to work again? It was beautiful fall weather. You know, if you're a man, and especially if you're older, you'll know the summer is a terrible time for testicles. And I was like, man, it's finally the summer, and I'm not sitting uncomfortably on myself all the time and being in pain when I'm walking and stuff anyway. And now I cause this to happen to myself, and it's just like, I'm never going to feel good again like this. And it was really and then I started to worry about maybe I made a mistake and cut myself off from the future, and maybe I just sunk into the pits of despair. And it took some days to get out of that, and another week or so to be relatively normal, able to move around without feeling like someone's – it wasn't like getting kicked. It was like someone was flicking you, you know, like pop.
Ow.
Every time you'd step. And so that wasn't pleasant at all. And I should say I still don't know that it's been successful because the thing I still have to do is to ejaculate into a jar and take it to a lab.
15 times.
And have them. Well, no. So it was, I had to ejaculate at least 15 times before to get all the old ammunition out before, to make sure the barrel was cleared before I did it, so they could tell if it was not getting in there, if there was some kind of leak. And, you know, I think I'm not alone in that the Trump's victory made me so depressed, it was hard to masturbate for a while. And, you know, so that made it difficult. And then, like, I just haven't wanted to go to the lab. And so
it's at the lab now and everything's fine.
No, well, I haven't taken it to the lab yet.
Oh, you have not done that?
I've still made way over the 15 number, but I just, you know, I just have been too lazy to, like, find the lab core or something that I have to take it to and go down to Canton and, like, am I going to hop on the bus with a jar of my ejaculate? And I just haven't figured out the logistics of that yet, how that's going to work. Or, like, can I go in there and
you can put it in a bag. Nobody has to look at it, you know what I mean?
Right, right. Or maybe I thought I could just go, like, hey, I haven't done this yet. Can I just go in your bathroom for a few minutes at the lab place? And like, I just don't know how that's supposed to work. Like, I thought that would be kind of fun to try to see if, like, hey, I have this jar I need to fill. Can I use your bathroom and see how they respond to that? But, yeah, so there's a lot of weird awkwardness with it. One thing, I'd never had an editor ask me to describe what happens. One of the editorial comments is, I need to know more about what happens after you get the procedure when you ejaculate. And so I'd never had an editor ask me to describe the consistency of my semen before. But it was an appropriate question, and it doesn't change very much. One male friend wrote and was worried it would be all watery and runny, and who was considering having the procedure. And I can assure the people out there that it's not. It's the same sort of milky thickness that you normally have.
Well, I'm glad this is good. I'm glad you recommend this. You should do a commercial about this. You know,
infomercial.
You should like go work for a urologist somewhere and just do these commercials about. Guess what? You know, it's still thick. See. One of the things that I found interesting, you didn't spend a lot of time on this, but I found it really interesting, was the first vasectomy performed in 1897 by Albert Ochsner, right? But he was also a founder of the eugenics movement.
Yeah.
So the history of vasectomies is tied up in eugenics.
Yeah, it really is. And it was to sterilize criminals and degenerates and poor people and people that you thought wouldn't be. I mean, it really shows that sort of way that eugenics is really connected with that concept of breeding and dogs and horses and stuff like that. And it's really disturbing. And so he performed the first one in conjunction with these ideas about eugenics and how we could make a better society through better breeding. And I discovered that and thought a lot about that, because one of the things people would say when we said we didn't want to have kids is, oh, you're just like that couple at the beginning of the movie Idiocracy, this intelligent, educated couple who...
I never saw the movie.
Who, it's terrible. It's not worth seeing. I mean, the one-line premise is good, though. So, like, the smart people are all like, oh, we're going to wait until the time's right, and they don't have kids, while uneducated people are popping them out every minute. And so then that has this, this guy gets frozen and wakes up in a world at some point later. And it's this crazy, ridiculous world where they've killed all the crops because they think Gatorade waters crops. And it's a dumb movie, a profoundly dumb movie. But everyone's like, oh, that's going to, if you don't have kids, we're going to end up with a worse species. And I'm just like, that's insane. That is such an insane eugenics idea. And I was shocked at how many people I know low-key endorse eugenics when they say that. And
oh, right. No, right. They don't even realize it's just right?
And so that made me even more like, yeah, I definitely have no – I don't think that the series of accidents and ejaculations that produced me like need to like continue on into the future. I feel very much a
– But who's going to carry your grocery bags when you get old?
Well, that was what my friend asked, and I figure you're far more likely to have your kid steal from you and accidentally burn your house down while smoking crack than carry your groceries, you know, and or if not, like, you know, but there was the question then of the which is sort of what led me into Nicole and I's relationship, the role we would have to play for each other is who's going to carry our metaphysical groceries as we get old. And yet we really feel like this large sense of community that we have in this city, especially, but also around the country, of people that we live very intentional lives with. And so I feel like we don't really have the worry about the groceries.
So just conclude with us here for a moment, just talk a bit about your post-vasectomy time. And what do you think? How do you think that's going to alter your life, and what it does for you and Nicole? I mean, where do you, It's done. And you'll finally get this thing to the lab and they'll see whether or not it's actually working. And the girl won't get pregnant. But I which would really be not good if, after all you've gone through here. It would be a horrible thing.
That would be horrible.
So, but talk about how you think this, where this takes your life. And Nicole's life together, having done this.
Yeah, I mean, the first big thing will be she will be able to stop taking birth control and see how that is for her. And then it's a sort of, I mean, it was almost like marriage. You know, how does marriage change your life or your relationship? It's just a ceremony. It's just a, in some ways it doesn't at all. But in other ways it does. And maybe this even more profoundly, because we made this decision, we made a commitment to the future, what we wanted for our future. And instead of just having to put a ring on it, I had to get cut open and chopped up. And so I think it was making a level of commitment to where we are in the future with each other. And so I feel like we feel better together and that we feel much more confident with where we'll be with each other in the future. And, I mean, if she ends up getting pregnant, I'll know, like, something else is going on that...
Nicole?
That I didn't know anything about. But I don't think that's something that I would have to worry about. But
I don't think so either.
But we... You know, I don't know. It's a really good question of will it change... I mean, the other thing that I've been really thinking a lot about, at the same time I wrote this, I wrote a piece that was in Salon about noticing these similarities between Trump and myself, which was a horrible realization. And it was during watching the third debate when he was talking over her and when he was and, you know, it was really this horrible realization that I sort of equated to when Luke Skywalker's training with Yoda and he cuts off Darth Vader's head and his own face rolls out of the mask. Like, that was this thing that I felt. And so I also felt like it made me more want to. I mean, I feel like she's doing pretty great. Like, if someone needs to work on our relationship, it's me. And so it was a pretty great way to for me to make this sort of commitment, in at least in my head, to being less of a white dude in my way I comport myself in the world. And so somehow those things, I think, go together. And, you know, I'm sure it's what those maniacs on the men's rights, alt-right, like horrible people would call cuckishness or something like that. But I would embrace the like, you know, well, I'm really glad those guys have a thing now. They're like, oh, withhold your sperm. Don't give it because it's power. Like, definitely. You guys are the last person that need to be having kids, too. Like, I take back everything I said about eugenics and stuff when I'm thinking about those guys. Like, don't have kids, alt-right people. Like, chop it off right now. And you'd do the world a favor. But I do think that it's helped me to sort of think about and by the way, the other functioning of you know, your performance and all of that stuff doesn't change at all. So it's really just that there's no human seeds that you're releasing. And so, yeah, I hope that it helps me to be a better person and to I hoped it would help my singing and I could hit those high soprano notes, but it didn't help me there.
Well, I can still do that. Good to have him in the studio, man.
Yeah, really great to be here. Always a pleasure, Mark.
Banner Woods in the house, and we'll be linking at steinershow.org to his piece in Vox that he wrote on his vasectomy. And we'll probably also link to that Trump piece because it's really interesting, written, which we didn't talk about today. So, Banner, thanks so much.
Yeah, hey, and a shout out to my friend John over on Charles Street. He always asking me when I'm going to go on Steiner again. And that's like, that's my one thing for him. So here I am, John.
All right. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Amani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Will Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. You can podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. For your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend and take care.